Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the beautiful Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Mark Dunley.
And I'm Andrea Cunliffe. Today we start with an interview with Bob Elft, who recently announced for a run for state senate as a Green Party candidate.
Then we talk with Kevin Zeese about his recent criminal trial for protecting the Venezuelan embassy in D.C. against the coup leaders and Donald Trump.
And later on, we hear another segment from Willie Terry about the slavery system in the U.S. during colonial times.
After that, we talk with Bob Connors for a preview on the Climate Action Film Festival.
And then finally, on Sanctuary Today, we speak with Dr. Robert Michaels about the Holocaust Essay Contest. But first, here are some news headlines.
The director of ICE, the United States Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, will hold a news conference Thursday at the Rensselaer County Jail at 11 a.m., at which local law enforcement officials will renew their call to change the New York Green Light Law, which blocks federal immigration and border enforcement agencies from accessing the state's motor vehicle database. The law allows undocumented immigrants to obtain driver's licenses.
Governor Cuomo's Medicaid redesign team will hold the third and final public comment session this Friday in Albany to solicit input on how the state can cut $2.5 billion from the program, which provides health care services to some 6 million New Yorkers. The forum will be held from 10 a.m. until 1 p.m. at Albany Capital Center, and that's at 55 Eagle Street. Lawmakers have criticized the process as secretive and rushed. People can sign up beginning at 9 a.m. that day.
The state of New York has provided $300,000 in funding to three projects in the Capital District to expand farm-to-school efforts to provide fresh produce to children. Capital Roots will receive a $100,000 grant for a program called Connecting Underserved Schools with Local Producers. Capital Roots is working with school districts in Saratoga, Schenectady, Albany, and Rensselaer counties.
And at Cross Gates Mall, well, they'll will pay the cost related to the town of Gilderland's placing two full-time officers in the mall. The mall has seen an increasing number of incidences.
They, in fact, had a stabbing last weekend. With the local government taking more control of the mall, civil liberty advocates want Cross Gates to comply with freedom of speech rights like other public places. Politico reports that the State Department of Environmental Conservation has issued proposed rules to restrict the use of hydrofluorocarbons, a potent greenhouse gas. The prohibitions on the refrigerants in certain items would be phased in from 2021 through 2024, ultimately applying to everything from grocery store refrigerators to car air quart conditioning systems. Comments are being accepted until March 16th.
And that's it for headlines. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC-LP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOS-LP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOA-LP 106.9 FM Albany, and WCAA-LP 107.3 FM Albany, coming to you from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy.
We're joined in the studio by Robert Elft, who I've known for decades as a peace and climate activist here in the Capital District. Bob recently announced that he will be seeking the Green Party nomination for State Senate and District 46, presently represented by Republican George Amador. Bob, why don't we start off with you telling us a little bit about yourself?
Well, I moved to the Capital District of Orrisville back in 1993. My family, we moved here from Dallas, Texas. Our big motivation for leaving Texas was we had young children that we were looking to send to school, and the public school situation around there didn't look very good. So we did a nationwide search and looked for jobs, and my wife found a good opportunity here and flew out for an interview and left Dallas. It was 99 degrees, landed here. It was partly cloudy and about 55 degrees. And I said, you can burn up my return trip ticket. I'm tired of the sun. And luckily she got the job. And so we ended up in Voorheesville. When we first got here, they said, you got to live in Voorheesville because that has the best education, the best public school system. And it turned out to be exactly the right thing.
Oh, that's wonderful. So why did you decide? Well, first of all, you're in number 46, right?
That's correct.
Now, where specifically is that? Is that still Voorheesville?
Yeah, the district is a boutique cut district. It's just exactly to
gerrymandered, you mean?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's the word. So it's when the politicians pick the voters and not the other way around. So we're the Republican district. And so it stretches all the way from, Amsterdam. It hits Woodstock. It goes down into Dutchess and Greene County. Picks up a little bit of Schenectady and Voorheesville along the way. It's definitely not a square or rectangle shape. It's all over the place.
Why did you decide to take this opportunity right now to run?
Well, the last election cycle, I went into the ballot, went into to vote, and I've been a Green Party member since, I don't know, when did we start having Green Party in New York?
1998, we got ballot status.
1998.
Grandpa Al Lewis.
That's
got
right.
50,000
That's votes. Right. I remember that. And so when I walked into the voting booth and looked at the ballot, the Green Party line had George Amador's name in it, the Republican. He stole our ballot line. And so that's not a good thing. In fact, I think that what we have to do is protect the ballot line for third parties. It's an important thing. There never would have been any talk about a Green New Deal had not Howie Hawkins and the Greens been talking about it for years ahead of time. Things that the Green Party has talked about are now being adopted into the so-called mainstream. But that's where all the fresh ideas are. That's where the young people look to do something different than what mom and dad are doing. And so I don't know, I was really excited when Peter asked me if I'd be interested in putting my name on that ballot line to protect the ballot line in the 46th district. And I said, sure.
You know, I'll mention that actually before Amador had stolen the ballot line from the Greens in the prior election, the Democrats had stolen the ballot line. And whoever has gotten the Green line has actually ended up being the winner because about 2,000 votes tend to come on the Green line, and that makes a difference. But what are some of the key issues, Bob, you hope to raise in this election?
Well, the thing I'd like to be able to talk about and raise some interest in is we've had the climate crisis and global warming and all these issues have been around for decades, and the pace of the action, the pace of the legislation, the pace of the political discussion has been so slow, and nothing has really tangibly been done. And in order to boost things and to keep things going, we need to get in there and keep that conversation going. And if all we're going to do is listen to the centrist Democrats on one hand and the Republicans who deny it's even happening on the other, there's a whole huge chunk of the conversation that never even makes it out there for voters to consider. So I'm not just holding a ballot place. I'm holding a place for people who want to put their vote towards those issues where the Democrats have failed and where the Republicans refuse to go.
That's pretty good. I like that. I like that a lot. But there's more than just, is the Green Party just stand for the environment? But they have other issues as well, no?
Right, a lot of issues. The whole issue of income inequality came from the Green Party. The whole idea of the single-payer health plan. That came from Green Party. When Jill Stein was coming through on her presidential run, she started talking about this crazy idea of why don't we eliminate college debt? I mean, we eliminated all the debt for Wall Street. Why can't we do this for the college students? And you know, we were up there in Matt's bakery up there, and I heard her say that. I was like, oh my God, she'll never get away with saying something like that. And now it's a main.
It's like policy.
Yeah, man. I know. It's, and so, you know, really good ideas and really important things can happen. But if all we depend on is the duality of one party or the other and shut out the third party movements, then these ideas aren't going to keep coming.
You see a time when the Green Party will actually hold seats on their own without having to be affiliated with one of the major parties.
Absolutely. It's bound to happen because just recently with the Democrats allowing themselves to be purchased by a Republican in the Republican, or I'm sorry, the Democratic primary, I get that mixed up a lot, for what, $300 and some million, he gets his ticket onto the stage. Well, the Green Party doesn't do that. The Green Party would never sell out like that. And people are seeing that in real time. And people aren't stupid. People are aware of this sort of thing going on. And when they start looking around for a place to go, we're here.
Now, a headline we wrote for tonight's news segment is that, you know, this week the governor's Medicaid redesign task force is meeting in Albany. Basically, how do we cut a couple billion dollars from health care for the poor because we have a $6 billion state budget deficit? How would you deal with, you know, this state budget deficit? Do you believe in taxing the rich? Do you believe in single-payer health care? How would you get us out of this mess?
You know, I've got this response from my assembly person years ago when I asked about why is it we're refunding all this money back to Wall Street on the transaction tax. You know, sometimes it's as much as $16 to $18 billion. We collect it and give it back every year since 1987. I think the last figure, they're not doing as many transactions maybe. It's a nickel a trade. Doesn't hurt Wall Street that much. But we have that kind of money that we do have room for in the budget. And that would be one place where this could come from. The other thing is pushing for a single-payer health plan. We just learned recently that it would indeed save $450 billion a year to go to single-payer nationally. So there's all kinds of ways to do this without, you know, constantly making cuts to important programs that people need.
Absolutely. How can we learn more about your campaign? Is there a website or are you around speaking? What can we do to keep you in our vision here?
Okay. Well, this has just started, so there will be a website very soon. And the Green Party has a website right now that GP.org, is that how it goes?
Well, GP.org, I believe, is the national. GPNY is the .org is the New York State one. And Providence is one for the Upper Hudson Green Party, but I don't know that one.
Yep. So the information will be out there. I plan on, if I'm invited to go to any candidate forums, I will be doing that. And I plan on, writing a letter to the editor. I've done that myself many times. I can do it for myself, I guess, this time.
So. Well, Bob, we want to thank you for joining us here on WOOC, and we'll certainly have you on back before the general election. But up next, I talk with Kevin Zeese, one of the four protesters in the Venezuelan embassy in D.C., who was prosecuted by the Trump administration, resulted in a hung jury last week. We're joined now by Kevin Zeese, who is one of four individuals that were prosecuted by the federal government for having, they spent 37 days trying to protect the Venezuelan embassy, but they were actually only prosecuted related to the last 4 days when the Trump administration moved to support the sort of illegitimate coup leader and got him out of the embassy. So Kevin, surprising mistrial last week. Can you give us a quick overview of what went on at the trial?
Yeah, it was pretty. We were very pleased with the mistrial. That was a very positive result. The jurors were unable to reach a unanimous verdict, and so the judge declared a mistrial. It was an unusual court because in that courtroom, unlike anywhere in the world, Juan Guaido was president. And that's because U.S. law has an anomaly in it that says that the president decides who is the leader of foreign countries, who's recognized as leader of foreign countries, and the courts cannot overrule that but must follow that decision. And so in that courtroom, the jurors were told that Guaido is president, even though he's not, hasn't been a president for even a nanosecond. We couldn't say that Maduro was president, and we had the permission of the Maduro administration to be in that embassy. That made a challenge for us. But we were able to get enough information out of the witnesses for the government saying that I had told them and Margaret had told them, other of us had told them that we were in the embassy legally, we had permission, that we were nonviolent, that, a lot of positive things along those lines from their cross-examination, that we need not even present a defense. We relied on that cross-examination, and it was enough doubt so that we got a hung jury. And after the trial, after the mistrial was declared, the judge allowed jurors to stay to take questions from the lawyers. Half the jurors stayed, and the bottom line was the jurors were totally confused. They had no idea what was going on. They said they were confused. They didn't understand why those 3 days in May, from May 13th to May 16th, why we're in the embassy for that. Why didn't we leave the embassy when the new president, they thought was Guaido, came into power? They were totally confused. But even with that confusion, they had doubts about the government's case, and that resulted in the mistrial. We'll find out on February 28th whether the government's going to prosecute us again. The Trump administration continues to pursue this coup. And so I think it's a very high-risk thing for them to prosecute us because another mistrial or an acquittal would be another punch to this failing coup.
Now, four of you were arrested, but in fact, as I said, the occupation went on for 37 days, and many more people were involved during the earlier parts. Can you maybe give us a little sense of what those 37 days were like?
Yeah, the first half of those days were easy. We could go in and out with no problem. We had forums every night, more than 100 people coming to these forums on a whole range of issues from Honduras to Venezuela to AFRICOM to what it's like to work in the CIA and be involved in regime change from inside the CIA. We had a CIA officer talk about that. And so that we had up to 70 people sleeping in the embassy and working in the embassy. So it was a pretty active event. The second half became much more stressful because there was a coup attempt again in Venezuela. It failed, but the same day we became surrounded by pro-coup advocates, a pro-coup mob that put us under siege, threatened us, blocked our food. In the end, our electricity was turned off, the water was turned off. People outside were assaulted. We had hundreds of people on our side supporting us outside. They had about 100 people on their side supporting the coup. And there were conflicts outside when people on our side were assaulted. They were arrested, even though they were the victims. People tried to throw us food. They were arrested for trying to throw food. There was throwing a missile was the charge for those offenses. So it seemed like the Secret Service, which is responsible for embassies, were working with this pro-coup mob to terrorize us to try to get us to leave the embassy. We stayed, and on the 13th, they delivered a trespass notice. We explained why the trespass notice was invalid, because we were there with permission, so we were not trespassing. And we stayed until the 16th when they arrested us that morning, storming the embassy with more than 100 police from 5 different police forces, many in militarized gear with militarized weapons, and they arrested us and charged us in federal court with interfering with the protective function of the State Department. They didn't charge the trespass or unlawful entry, but interfering with the State Department. The judge in the case is the chief judge for the U.S. District Court, and she ruled as she did to limit what we could say. We limited it to those 3 days, which confused the jurors completely. We were not allowed to mention who the real president was, who the real ambassadors were, and that confused him as well. So even with that confusion, we were successful in getting a mistrial.
Now, there must be, you know, Venezuelan embassies, certainly in, you know, major countries around the planet. Did any other, you know, place, you know, exhibit this type of, you know, behavior where the elected Venezuelan government told people to help protect our embassy and the host government tried to throw them out to support the coup leader? Or is this unique to D.C. and the United States?
Embassies have become a tool of U.S. coups, and there's an excellent movie about that. But on the same day that our embassy was surrounded by a pro-coup mob, other Venezuelan embassies were also surrounded. Popular movements in those countries and the embassy staff were able to fight them off. The movie that about this talked about how we inspired many of those popular movements because they saw us standing up for more than a month. They came out and pushed back against attempts to take over the Venezuelan embassies in multiple countries on the same day. So this seemed like a strategy on the part of the United States and the pro-coup advocates because they could not win in Venezuela. They can't win an election in Venezuela. They can't have a successful coup in Venezuela. The people support Maduro. He won re-election. I was at that election and saw the election, very well-run election. He won with 67% of the vote in a five-person race. And so they can't win elections. They can't conduct a coup. So they're going outside the country and trying to put in place a fake government outside the country. But so far, the Venezuelan embassy in Washington, D.C. is vacant. They have not taken it over. They went in for a photo op, but that's it. Right now, it's a vacant embassy, so there is no active Venezuelan embassy in Washington, D.C.
Now, the coup leaders, you know, sort of whatever legitimacy he was trying to argue was based on, you know, having support in the National Parliament, National Assembly. But, you know, recently it seems like even the National Assembly and the other opposition parties have turned against him and said, you know, get out of here. You're not helping us at this point.
That's very true. There, Juan Guaido is surrounded by corruption. He's being investigated for corrupt activities regarding the U.S. funding, which has been tens of millions of dollars in U.S. funds trying to support this coup. And as a result, there was a vote, an annual vote they have for the leadership of the National Assembly. Guaido had been president, and that was his basis for claiming the overall presidency of Venezuela. But in this most recent election in January, they elected four leaders, a president, two vice presidents, and one secretary. All four are from opposition to Maduro, but they did not support Juan Guaido as president. So Juan Guaido no longer has the leadership position in the opposition. He no longer is the president of the assembly. He's still a member of the National Assembly, but he barely got into that. He was in from the second smallest state in Venezuela. He came in second in the race with 22%, and that was enough to get into the legislature, but he was never a very powerful legislator in the assembly. So he was a fraud from the beginning, and now he has no basis. In fact, when he just finished his world tour funded by the United States, he came back to Venezuela. The first thing that happened was the passport official took his passport because it was illegal for him to leave the country. So he's not a president when an official at the border can take your passport. Then he was protested in the airport, outside the airport, chased away from it. He was called an assassin and a traitor. People are very angry at Juan Guaido because he's advocating for more economic sanctions, which have caused 40,000 deaths in the last 2 years, according to the Center for Economic Policy Research. And he also is calling for the U.S. to militarily intervene in his own country. So he is seen as a traitor to the people of Venezuela. He has no political support in the country.
We've been talking to Kevin Zeese, one of the four individuals who got a mistrial in the occupation of Venezuela. In the last 15 seconds, people want more information. Kevin, how can they keep track of this or the situation in Venezuela?
Two places, defendembassyprotectors.org. That's defendembassyprotectors.org is our legal defense committee. And then our website that Margaret Flowers and I work at, Popular Resistance, that's popularresistance.org, where we cover this as well as other movement issues. So popularresistance.org and defendembassyprotectors.org.
And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
And the prosecution has not yet announced whether they intend to seek a retrial. And for those of you who are just turning in, I think I'm sitting next to Mark Dunley. However, I am Andrea Cunliffe, and you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, WOOC LP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOS LP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOA LP 106.9 FM Albany, and WCAA LP 107.3 FM Albany. Coming to you from the beautiful Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org or get in touch with us through email at hmm@mediasanctuary.org.
And our next segment is Willie Terry. He's attended the Hudson Valley Community College lecture on Field and Freedom and Enslavement in Early American. In part two of his series, he speaks with historian Lavada Nehran as she compared the depiction of Mount Vernon, Virginia, with the unique food culture of colonial New York.
Because my cornbread was based on chili and heavy, hot, spicy sauces. Not sweet, light things, not souffle-like things. So there is a difference, and that regionality is really important, and we need to keep that regionality in mind when we talk about enslavement. As I said in my talk, in the South, because people like George Washington and other plantation owners are holding all of their enslaved as one community, they then give them separate places to live. They give them food rations. They give them cabins with hearths so they can cook for themselves. Here in the North, you don't have one person holding that many enslaved. But on their estates, you may have that many enslaved. So for instance, when we were looking at some place like Phillips Manor, where you have 52,000 acres broken into hundreds of smaller farms, there's one enslaved, two, three enslaved on each of those farms. So there is no justification of them having their own place to live. You put them on the floor in your kitchen, right? You put them up in your attic. You put them in the basement. Why are you going to spend the time and the money to give them a space to live where they have to cook for themselves? It is better to work them to the dark of night in the field and then give them some scraps off your own table. So that's a different structure, and that's why it's really important to keep that regionality, because in that we think that there were not that many slaves here because we look at one house and we just see one, but you're not looking at the whole estate. And on that whole estate, there may be hundreds, but that whole estate isn't like the 8,000 acres that George Washington has. It's the 52,000 acres that the Phillips family had. You know, so that's a big difference. So the numbers are here, but they're just held very differently.
So what are some places that if someone want to, you know, go and look at some of these estates or mansions here, they could go? Where are some of the places?
All over. You can start in Albany at Schuyler Mansion. You can go to Saratoga at one of the other Schuyler houses that they have there. You can start right here in Albany at Cherry Hill, which was Van Rensselaer's. You can go all up and down the Hudson River, because no matter where you are, they were there.
What about anything in Troy?
Troy has a lot of smaller places, and so I would start at your local library. I would start at your local historic society. And there's a talk actually coming up here. The next talk next month is being given by Dr. Jennifer Burns, who has done extensive research on the colonial and New Nation period in Troy. And she's going to be presenting here. So a lot of documentation is coming out about Troy.
Now here at the college, you know, you came and talked to students. And I know one thing you was kind of alluding to, that there's a lot more research and things
yes.
that have to be done.
Yes.
So what would you kind of ask students to look into this and why it's important?
We need to look into it, because to get Southern history out of here, we need to publish more books. We need to publish more articles. We need to have more talks like this on the radio. We need to correct the narrative that our younger students are dealing with in school. And it would also help for a lot of parent-teacher associations to bring in historians to help parents understand where the scholarship is now. Many of us, who went to school earlier than 10 years ago, are really dealing with old scholarship. A lot has happened in a very short amount of time, and we need to be able to support our students, whether they are elementary school age or up to college age, in what they are dealing with on the day-to-day. And we can't do that because we're dealing with old scholarship. So it is easy. Just start in your library. I would hope everyone has a library card, and I would hope that they use the librarians as the resources, because that's the fastest way to get the information out. And I just know a lot of people are saying, well, I can find it on Google. Well, actually, you can't, because to go to Google means that you are dealing with, one, old information, and you're dealing with the absence of a lot of the current scholarship, because the academic books aren't being posted there. So I would say start at your local library.
Now, how long is this exhibit will be shown here in the Capitol?
I believe it will be up for the next 3 months, and I do encourage people from the community to come to the library here and to see it. Mm-hmm. But I also encourage them to look at their own family history, mm-hmm. And to look at their neighborhood history. But I believe it will be on exhibit for the next 3 months. Uh-huh. It is also a web-based exhibit, so do a Google search for Fire and Freedom, and it is from the National Library of Medicine. And you have all of the panels from the exhibit. You also have a large amount of support material and academic material behind it to help encourage you to be curious.
All right.
So now I'll put on my glasses. Does anyone have any questions? Yes.
You said before that a lot of the runaway slaves would try to take ships back to Europe or Africa. Did they ever try to go to Canada? Was that ever?
It depends on the time. Okay. One of the things that we don't realize, there was slavery in Canada.
Right.
So depending on the time period, that was not a safe place to go. And particularly until we get to the middle of the 18th century, that was really nowhere for them to escape to, because slavery existed in Britain.
Okay. Right.
So they have really a dance around where they can go,
right.
But depending on the time period. Anyone else? Yes, ma'am.
That was wonderful, thank you.
You're welcome, thank you.
I've been to the Livingston House in Claverack. It's a yellow house where the orchard is.
Yes. One of the cousins.
That house, how did that fit into the larger picture when you talked about the big Livingston Phillips Manor?
Well, the Livingston estate was really large, and it was broken up, and then they also got more. I only tracked the one immediate line from the founder of Livingston Manor, but it's a large family. They have a lot of brothers and sisters and cousins and things like that.
That house is still in their family privately owned.
Yeah, the Livingstons are still rolling in the dough. Yes, ma'am.
I'm excited to know what your new job will allow you to do, what kind of layers of interpretation you're going to be able to bring to the museums and sites in New York.
Well, that's interesting, because I asked them what they wanted me to do, and then they looked at me and said, so what do you want to do? So part of it really is me crafting a scope of work. Part of it is, and my time period has expanded. So I've gone from 17th to 19th century, now I'm all the way up to the 20th century. So it is about working with the historic sites to help the staffs work through their challenges around discussing enslavement. That's the first. It is helping to do research. It is about helping them put together programs. And it is about looking at opportunities in every which way. For instance, this is the anniversary year of the 19th Amendment,
right? Everybody knows women got the right to vote, right? Wrong. White women got the right to vote. African American women did not get the right to vote until 1965 Voters' Rights Act.
So this is sort of a really big question.
Okay.
So if we were to get the South out of our New York history, so we had a better city of New York history, how do you think that might change how we think about New York's present?
Well, I think it would help us to understand that, first of all, that whole, no matter where we are in New York, we are so money-centric. It would help us to understand that that was not something that was imposed upon us as a new thing, but that was something that was imposed from the very beginning. Also, it would help us to see that from the very beginning, the diversity that is New York existed. Like, the first people that the Dutch sent here were not Dutch. They were Walloons. And then right behind them, you have the Sephardi Jews show up, and then you have Quakers, and you have all these people initially, because the Netherlands was a place that a lot of people who were being persecuted in Europe went to before they came here. So even though we have people like the Livingstons, that they're not Dutch, they're Scottish, but they were dealing with religious persecution. So they went from Scotland to Holland, then to here. So a lot of people pass through Holland. It would help us to understand that, and I would hope it would help us be more tolerant and more honest. And it would also probably help us correct our abuse and ignoring of the native peoples who were here first. It would help us to embrace the fact that if you're not native, you came from somewhere else. And here, the immigrant population is because we're all immigrants, whether forced or willing. If you are not native, you're an immigrant. So that is what I would hope it would shift. To help encourage you to be curious.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's Lavada
Nahan.
Interpreter from the African American History Park Recreation and Historic Preservation, speaking on the exhibit Fire and Freedom, Food and the Enslavement of Early America. Thank you.
Thank you.
And that was our Roman labor correspondent, Willie Terry, with part two of Fire and Freedom and Enslavement in Early America.
Next up, Bob Connors of Community Advocates for a Sustainable Environment speaks with Hudson Mohonk magazine correspondent Steve Pierce about the Climate Action Film Festival scheduled for March the 4th at the Spectrum Theater in Albany.
Welcome, Bob. Tell us a little bit about the film festival.
Yeah, it is a unique event in terms of environmental films, in the sense that most of the ones I've been to over the years have been very depressing. And this particular one, the focus is on climate solutions and actions related to that. And it's really terrific. We'll be having 10 films, short films adding up to roughly 90 minutes. And it's being produced by a group called Sun Common, based in Rhinebeck. And they decided to do something like this because nothing has been done before in terms of showing solutions to problems rather than just, you know, being upset or depressed by the problems. So they've gotten together. They reviewed over 225 films and picked the 10 best in their opinion. And they put it all together as a package, and I heard about it maybe 2 months ago and called them and said, let's do one in Albany. So we are. This film festival will be in Albany at the Spectrum Theater on Wednesday night, March 4th, from 7 to 9 p.m.
Sounds great. Now, it's not just films, right? You're going to have a discussion as well?
Yeah, and afterwards, we should be having roughly 30 minutes available to us, depends on the theater's policies, but we do have the place reserved from 7 to 9 p.m., so we should have roughly 30 minutes of discussion. And what will happen is our group, again called Community Advocates for a Sustainable Environment, will be discussing what we do in the community and what events we have coming up as well. And there'll be a bit of back and forth, I'm sure, with the audience on questions they have about the film or they want to know more. And all, you know, we'll do what we can do in 30 minutes.
So what is your goal with this film festival?
Well, the goal of our group is education about an environment to begin with, and this is just a furtherance of that. And we want people to realize that, you know, the expression darkness before dawn, we know things are getting worse on an accelerating pace in our environment, not only locally, but worldwide. And it is easy to get depressed or upset. But what we want to have people do is think beyond that and say, look, here's 10 films. These particular films are taken from events all around the world. And say, look what these people are doing. Look what they're doing. And they're people like you and me. They're no different. That, granted, some are more advanced scientists and so on. But many of the films involve local people who just said, I can do this. And, for example, there's one film produced by John Bauermaster, who's well-known in this area, a local man. He produced one about a farm, a carbon farming techniques in Red Hook, or I should say the Hudson Valley. And it's very inspiring to see what these farmers are doing with keeping carbon in the ground. Now, that's just one example of the 10 films.
I think I've heard of one of the films on the lineup. There's a it features a girl, I think, right, who Jason Mellers. She was an organizer. I think it's called Words Have Power, and she organized against a power plant and was, you know, speaking at rallies and City Hall and all that, and actually shut down a coal-fired power plant proposal.
That's exactly what she did. Beginning at age 10, she was an asthmatic and probably still is, and lived in a particularly ravaged environmental community with pollution, all kinds of power plants and frack gas being burned and so on, and dumps in her community, which is happens to be Bridgeport, Connecticut. And at her young age, she got things organized to the point where, you're right, that the coal-fired power plant will be shut down in 2021. So here's a case of what a 10-year-old can do. Well, you know, she aged out as time went on, of course, but she started it at age 10.
We have on the phone Bob Connors, who's with the Community Advocates for a Sustainable Environment. They are co-sponsoring the Climate Action Film Festival, which takes place at the Spectrum Theater in Albany on March 4th. Now, it sounds like you're expecting big crowds and you're encouraging people to purchase tickets in advance. What do people need to do that?
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that. They simply can go several places, but I think the simplest one is to our webpage, which is www.caseonline.org. And there's you'll see the listing of buyer tickets here. You just click on it, or we should say reserve your tickets, because you're right. In the past, I think they've had three, maybe four major events now, in both in Vermont and in New York, and every one of them has sold out in advance. And some people were disappointed, you know, when they walked into the theater expecting to buy tickets. Now, this particular theater, the Spectrum in Albany, does hold 180 people, which would be the biggest venue they've used so far. But we do expect to sell out, and there's also a Facebook page that they can go to, and as well, there's this some words that'll say "find tickets," and you just click on that, and the page is called Climate Action Film Festival is the Facebook page, and when people go to our own, if they chose to go to our webpage, it's right on the front page, all the information that they're going to need about this film festival.
So the thing that sets this apart from all the other environmental films everywhere is that these are all action stories. It's not about doom and gloom. It's really about what people can do to help.
Exactly. And again, these are everyday people from all around the world. One doesn't have to be a scientist or someone with a master's degree in ecology or something like that. Many of the people in these films have advanced degrees, as I mentioned, but the majority of the films are about average people, including the, I don't want to give away too much, Steve, but the first little film features a well-known young lady by the name of Greta Thunberg, who's caught the world by surprise, and is leading not only young people, but adults, people from all around the world, into climate action, and she sort of introduces the films that are going to be presented. And she's inspired so many people, and she's amazing for a teenager. And, in addition, this company producing it called Suncommon, they are, I won't dwell on it much, but there's something called a Corporation B, which means they have to do, to maintain their tax status, they have to do a lot for the community, and they're certainly doing it with this film festival. They've done everything. They've gotten the films, they've reserved the theater, they're doing the promotions, marketing, and of course we're helping. But in addition, all the proceeds from this film, and they also will be selling some recycled T-shirts or at the recycled materials to produce the T-shirts. They're taking all those proceeds and donating to our group, which we will use to continue all the environmental type work that we do.
And tell us a bit about Community Advocates for a Sustainable Environment. What is that organization?
Well, it's a, I guess you could call it a sister group or a cousin to our original group, which is called Stop New York Frack Gas Pipeline. And we organized to fight the Northeast Energy Direct Pipeline. And we won that campaign along with help from Massachusetts and New Hampshire, of course. But we had, at the time, over 2,000 people email addresses. And they're, of course, we're pleased that this pipeline was withdrawn. But we decided to do something proactive instead of just waiting for a problem to emerge and try to fight that off. So we formed our group here. The acronym is CASE. And we put on our biggest event is the annual Renewable Energy and Sustainable Living Fair. It's in the fall. In the past, it was at Sage College in Albany. And we do environmental forums. And, of course, this film festival is our latest activity.
Sounds great. Well, thanks very much, Bob. We'll look forward to seeing you at the movies.
And that was Bob Connors of Community Advocates for a Sustainable Environment, and the Climate Action Film Festival is scheduled for March 4th at Spectrum Theaters in Albany.
And that sounds great. Okay, Schenectady Today host Ann Perillo is speaking with Dr. Robert Michaels about the Holocaust Essay Contest, which covers the 12 countries surrounding, or counties, that covers the 12 counties surrounding Albany County.
But right now I have Dr. Robert Michaels on, and we're going to be talking about the essay contest and how far reaching is this contest and who's eligible to join in and write an essay on the theme. Tell us about it.
This is a non-commercial contest which is put on as a public service for high school and middle school students in a 12-county area.
12 counties, that's a big area.
Contiguous with Schenectady and Albany, so mm-hmm. You can look at a map, or you can look at our website, and it's
sure.
Up there.
So that'd be Montgomery and all of those, yeah.
12 counties,
yeah.
And it's bbheck.org.
Mm-hmm.
The rules, the deadlines, the essay question itself, all are posted along with educational resources that teachers can use for their classes.
Now, you know, something came up when I was reading about this, that is the Holocaust taught in all schools, or is this something that, well, we're moving on, there's other things to deal with?
Well, there is a segment in New York, as I will make clear when we look at the essay question. There are 11 states, including New York, that require education about the Holocaust.
Only 11 states?
Out of, you know, 50. So that's 80% that don't. And the question that we're posing this year asks whether we might expand that number of states, because that would expand the exposure of students, and specifically what kinds of lessons from the Holocaust might be appropriate to improve students' appreciation of diversity, ethnic diversity, cultural diversity, and to reduce the kind of intolerance that we're seeing today. We want our students to appreciate diversity. They are our future leaders.
I couldn't agree with you more. And as I said in my last segment, when we were talking about the Russian, we really need to understand other cultures and ethnic groups, because we are so much alike, but we don't. We seem to put up barriers.
We do, and we try to break those barriers down. I like to think that we will get several hundred, perhaps, this year. But we've been doing this for close to four decades.
I know you, yeah.
And that means
Did
that
I
we have.
42nd year, is that something like that?
I can't remember the number.
I don't know. I think I wrote it down while you're talking. I'll take a look at my notes and see. Well, I think I wrote it down.
It is a long time.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've had not only a lot of winners, we have six people, students, three from middle school and three from high school each year, who win a cash prize, and we give out $1,000 in
cash
prizes.
Those are nice prizes, yeah.
And for everyone that wins, there are many who participate who have an opportunity to study the Holocaust on their own.
What is your topic? Do you change the topic every year? And what is your topic this year?
This year, I think you should have a...
Yeah, they did have it up.
Oh, it was up there, okay. Yeah. So the topic this year relates to the fact that only 11 states require the teaching about the Holocaust, and we're asking the question, should the number of states be increased, and what lessons of the Holocaust of World War II might best improve students' appreciation of ethnic and cultural diversity that we experience in our country, and reduce intolerance, which we are experiencing, unfortunately, in this country.
Yeah, yeah.
So we have had a legacy now of probably tens of thousands of students who have now become our teachers, our community leaders, our parents. These are people who are out there now. We're not talking about students. Now we're talking about the fact that there are thousands of people who are affected by this contest, and I would hope positively affected.
And we're losing at this point in time, as we are losing our World War II veterans. You know, many of them are passing. We are losing maybe some of the history, the oral history of people that were involved with that. So it's important to keep this history going so that we can document.
I can't agree with you more, and I'll tell you that there is an oral history component, so that people who are survivors of the Holocaust get to tell their stories in archive films and interviews, and so that is underway, and the question is to keep those memories alive, and for me, most important, to keep those lessons alive so that we can prevent this kind of thing from happening.
Well, you know, it's funny that you say that, because we say we learn from history, and yet we do know that as we look at what's happening in the world today with the pogroms, and I mean they're in different countries with different ethnic groups, different religious groups, it seems like we always have to be fighting somebody. Don't we ever learn?
Good question.
There's no answer.
Not from me. I hope we learn.
But it disturbs me every time I pick up the paper and I go, haven't we learned? Why can't we live in peace? Why can't we grow our flowers and our vegetables and go to market, and everybody in the world just has a peaceful life? I mean, I'm just digressing, guys.
Peace on earth, and I guess my biggest lesson has been to avoid listening to the news or reading the newspaper.
I don't listen to it all
in the evening, because it stops me from sleeping.
Yeah, well, exactly. Now, You also have, you mentioned that there's a deadline for them to get these in, and that's the 21st, did you say?
Yeah, they have an option to email them or to use the postal service.
Okay.
In that case, it's a postmark.
Do they have to go through the school? I mean, what if they're homeschooled?
Well, they, usually the teachers who assign their kids to do an essay for this contest will collect those essays and submit them to me by email or by the postal mail, postmarked by the 21st of April. Okay. This year we may actually manage to have an upload option. Students can do it. They don't have to have a sponsoring teacher. We prefer to have a sponsoring teacher.
Okay.
And for obvious reasons, I don't prefer to communicate directly with students.
No, and I understand. You want to keep away from that and it being touching the base, so to speak. Dr. Robert Michaels, we've been talking about the essay contest, and I'm sure he'll... I hope that as we get this award ceremony coming up, he'll come back again and maybe read a portion of the winning essay. That would be wonderful. I would love to hear that.
So. Yes, I would love to do that.
We'll do that. We'll set a date. You've been listening to Dr. Robert Michaels from the V'nai B'rith Holocaust Essay Contest. And you're listening to WOOC-FM, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Ann Perilla, host for Schenectady Capital Region.
And that was another one of our Schenectady Today segments. Now we have a quick special interview by Andrea of Congressman Paul Tonko.
With Paul Tonko at Guinea School here in East Greenbush, you just donated 35 books to fifth grade, well, to the whole library of the school. You want to give us just a quick
sure.
on that?
A Library of Congress program that allow, they call it a surplus book program. So they have surplus books, and they're available to every member of the House of Representatives. We get quite proactive, not quite very proactive, and perhaps aggressive about reaching out to our school systems, our libraries, our education centers, so that they can have some of the resources coming their way. As I shared with fifth graders at the school, it's important to see the book as a friend because they can stretch your thinking, they can allow you to self-discover, they can take you to places you've never been. That's all part of quality education, self-discovery.
That's fine. You've also been very active with the National Endowment for the Arts recently, and I know Sanctuary for Independent Media was granted something nice. Thank you for arranging that.
Oh, my pleasure. We try to support the applicants from the district for the NEA revenue sharing, and I think that, you know, the arts are significant to our community. The opportunity to have interaction and challenges met in our community through centers like this enable us, with their empowerment of the NEA grant money, to be all the stronger. And so I'm very impressed that they had a winning application. We're very thrilled to be part of the reinforcement for their application and to announce the award. I get very, again, very proactive and aggressively so to, in these austere budgets, to draw down as many resources as we can for the people we represent.
Well, you strongly supported the Capital Region, and that was really nice because Schenectady, RPI, Schenectady? No.
I believe it was...
Can you, I have that here, which can be heard on our podcasts as well. Okay, that concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Andrea.
And I understand that Paul Tonko podcast has a little information about climate change for our fans out there. I'm Mark Dunley. Our engineer tonight is Spencer Keeble. Remember to tune in every weekday to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose through the Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. You can email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org.
And as a reminder, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in volunteering with our radio effort, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org or just stop by one of our weekly meetings on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m., held right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy. Well, until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.